Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Refinance Rescission Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 13, 2015, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Jezinoski v. Countrywide Home Loans. The question in this case was whether, under the terms of the Truth in Lending Act, a borrower may rescind a mortgage transaction merely by notifying the lender in writing within 3 years of the finalization of the transaction, or must instead file a lawsuit within the same time period. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia for a unanimous court, the court held that the borrower need only provide written notice to the lender within the 3-year period, not file suit. The decision of the Eighth Circuit was reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings. To discuss the case, we have John Ohlendorf, who is an associate at the law firm Cooper & Kirk, PLLC. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Ohlendorf.
The Supreme Court's recent opinion in Jezinoski versus Countrywide Home Loans Incorporated answers really a question of statutory interpretation under the Truth in Lending Act, or TILA, having to do with TILA's grant to home loan borrowers of a right to rescind their mortgage within a certain period of time. So TILA, enacted in 1968, was meant to ensure the informed use of consumer credit, and specifically with respect to home loans, it does this mainly by requiring that borrowers receive certain disclosures when they take out a mortgage, for example, you know, telling them what their monthly payment is going to be or how interest will be calculated on the mortgage and that sort of thing. And importantly for this case, TILA also gives home loan borrowers 3 days after entering into the mortgage in which they can rescind or cancel the mortgage for any reason, a sort of 3-day cooling off period. And the statute says in Section 1635A that a borrower rescinds, quote, by notifying the creditor of his intention to do so, close quote. Now, to make sure that borrowers are aware of this rescission right, TILA requires, along with the other disclosures that I just mentioned, that lenders inform borrowers about this right, rescission, and how to exercise it. And TILA provides that the 3-day clock for the cooling off period doesn't start to run until the disclosures are made. And Congress's idea here seems to be that, you know, if a lender is tardy in delivering these notices, the borrower will still have 3 days after first hearing about the rescission right to exercise it. Now, what if the lender never makes the required disclosures? Well, to keep these rights of rescission from just sort of lingering around indefinitely and clouding up thousands of titles, Section 1635F of the statute provides that even if the disclosures are never made, the rescission right expires after 3 years. Now, all of this is pretty straightforward in the simple case where, for example, a borrower, you know, sends notice just within the 3 years that it wants to rescind, and the lender looks at the file, it agrees that it didn't give the required notices, and so it says, okay, we'll wind up the mortgage. That's pretty straightforward. But in this case, things unfortunately weren't quite that straightforward. So Larry and Cheryl Jezinoski refinanced their mortgage in 2007 with Countrywide, and just short of 3 years later, on sort of the day before the three-year clock ran out, the Jezinoskis sent a letter to Countrywide claiming that they didn't get the full notice that TILA required and purporting to exercise their right of rescission. So the lender gets this notice, they look at the file, and they conclude that they actually did give all the notice that TILA requires, and they refuse to start the process of unwinding the mortgage. And as a result of that, the Jezinoskis brought this lawsuit in federal court seeking to enforce their right, but of course by the time they filed the suit, the 3-year clock had run. So the tricky question in these contested cases where the borrower, you know, sends the notice of intent to rescind within the 3-year period, but the rescission is then contested and the borrower files suit to enforce the rescission after the 3-year clock has run out, the tricky question is whether that lawsuit is still timely. So it turns out that the circuits had actually split on this question, and the split was basically hanged on, you know, what constitutes the exercise of the right of rescission. So the 3rd, 4th, and 11th circuits had concluded, really just basically reasoning from the plain text of the statute, that a borrower exercises her right of rescission, quote, by notifying the creditor of his intention to do so, close quote. And by contrast, the first, sixth, eighth, ninth, and tenth circuits had concluded that the borrower not only has to send this notice, but also has to initiate a court action seeking rescission before the three-year clock has run out if the rescission is contested. So the Supreme Court, in a unanimous six-page opinion by Justice Scalia, agreed with the former position. It concluded, again, based on just the plain text of the statute, that a borrower exercises her right of rescission by sending notice of her intent to rescind. And since the Jezinoskis had done this before the three-year clock ran out, their exercise was timely, even though they didn't get around to filing suit until after 3 years. And I think on balance, the court probably got this right. The court certainly didn't seem to have any trouble with the question. As I mentioned, it issued a six-page opinion. But in the last few minutes, I'd like to talk about two of the arguments in favor of the view that the court rejected, really with the goal of seeing what they have to say about the current state of statutory interpretation. So there's sort of a standard story about the recent history of statutory interpretation, that sort of in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, courts were really strongly purposivist. That is, they tended to interpret statutes in light of the purpose that they thought Congress sort of had in mind when it passed the statute, and courts really felt pretty free to disregard the plain meaning of a statute's text if it felt that that text was getting in the way of what Congress was trying to accomplish, the purpose that Congress was driving at. But starting in the 80s and 90s, courts have taken a more textualist view, the idea being that judges, for a variety of reasons, are bound to enforce the plain meaning of a statute's text, even if in their view Congress's purpose points in a different direction. And I think the story is sort of largely right, and I think it says something that's really correct about the current practice of statutory interpretation, which I think is strongly textualist right now. What I want to suggest is that the two arguments that the court rejected in Jezinoski nevertheless show that the sort of current consensus about statutory interpretation is actually a little bit more complicated. So one argument that Countrywide had advanced has to do with the distinction between two types of rescission that existed before TILA, rescission at law and rescission at equity. So at law, you could get your contract rescinded just by giving notice without filing a lawsuit, just as the Jezinoskis claimed. But to do this, you had to, at the outset, tender back any property that you'd received under the contract. Now, if you didn't want to make this initial tender, you could still get rescission at equity, but at equity, you had to file a lawsuit. Rescission wasn't accomplished by notice. It was accomplished by the judicial decree after you filed a lawsuit. And Countrywide's argument is basically, look, you know, this Congress couldn't have had rescission in law in mind in TILA because it didn't require that initial tender back. So it must have had rescission at equity in mind. And because one of the long-standing requirements of rescission at equity is that you file a lawsuit and TILA doesn't specifically say anything to the contrary, it should be read as leaving this long-standing principle of equity intact. And Justice Scalia sort of gives the back of his hand to this argument. But what I want to suggest is that the argument isn't at least crazy. Right. So very frequently the court will do this with statutes. So imagine a court is reading a new criminal statute that just doesn't say anything about mens rea. It's very likely that the court is going to read into the statute sort of the background common law principles of mens rea. And more generally, when Congress legislates today, it does so against sort of a pretty crowded backdrop of all sorts of legal norms from regulations, from previous state and federal statutes, from state and federal common law. And in any given statute, Congress likely means to depart from some of these pre-existing rules, but it also likely means to leave some of them intact. And figuring out which is an increasingly difficult, but I think increasingly important part of statutory interpretation. And it's a part of statutory interpretation that the traditional debate between textualists and purposivists just doesn't say that much about. Now, the second argument that Countrywide made that I think is significant has to do with Section 1635A's textual context. So Countrywide had pointed to a bunch of different provisions in Section 1635 that seemed to suggest that rescission would be accomplished by judicial action. So, for example, 1635G describes rescission as a type of relief that a court can award. And 1635C provides that certain things that a borrower does at closing create a rebuttable presumption that TILA had been complied with, which again sort of seems to contemplate judicial action rather than just notice. Now, as Justice Scalia rightly points out, none of these other provisions specifically says that a borrower has to file a lawsuit to accomplish rescission. But what I think is interesting is that just opting for textualism rather than purposivism doesn't get you to this result. And that's really because textualists like Scalia have very strongly insisted that they read statutory texts in context. And Scalia especially has been very emphatic that a statute should be read as a whole, should be read to sort of make sense as a whole. And I think one can very reasonably argue, as Countrywide did, that reading 1635A to allow a borrower to accomplish rescission just through notice sort of makes nonsense out of these other sections, paragraphs G and C. And what I think is especially interesting about this argument is that you could run pretty much the identical argument as a purposivist argument, right? The idea being that sort of the purposes of the three-year limit, you know, removing cloud on title and that kind of thing, would be offended by interpreting 1635A in the way the Jezinoskis do. And in fact, several of the courts below that adopted Countrywide's view of 1635A did so on the basis of this emphatically purposivist argument. So I think the takeaway from that is that because textualists agree that statutory texts have to be interpreted in context, if the context is cashed out in a broad enough way, it's possible essentially to repackage a bunch of really purposivist arguments as textualist arguments that rely on sort of a coherent or holistic reading of the statute as a whole. And in this case, the court rejected this contextualist reading, concluding that these other provisions just weren't on point. But I think the important point is that even if textualism has carried the field, we're still left with this really significant question of what types of context should count when we're interpreting statutory texts, and how much they should count for. And this, again, is something that I think those who write about textualism and who practice textualism on the bench just have a lot more work left to do in figuring out.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.